Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Top 10 Lawsuits number 2, The Dancing Baby. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is, drum roll, Chris Cook.
Hello.
Hang on. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Don't
beat you. Got in first there.
That bit.
You don't own hello.
You've derailed the podcast. Let's just stop.
I can say hello first.
You've ruined this.
That's what the law says.
Anyway, this is another in our new series of special episodes of the show, looking at our 10 favourite music industry lawsuits. This time, it's Prince versus the Dancing Baby. Which, obviously, why would that not be one of your favourites? I mean, we could give it its official title, which is Lentz versus Universal Music Corp. But Prince versus Dancing Baby, way more fun. The long-running case tested the obligations of takedown issuers to consider whether unlicensed use of their copyright is fair use. It took so long that it outlived Prince by 2 whole years.
Yes. Prince wasn't actually really actively involved in the case.
No, despite it being an internet-related lawsuit and Prince, during the latter part of his life, being quite litigious when it came to stuff on the internet involving him.
But it was, as you've already said, Universal Music, or specifically Universal Music Publishing, who was the music industry player in this case. Meanwhile, Stephanie Lentz was the other side. She was the mother of the Dancing Baby. So this case begins all the way back in 2007, the very early days of YouTube. Hard to believe that, really, isn't it? Sort of feels like YouTube's been part of your life forever.
Yeah, I remember watching YouTube in the 80s. Saturday mornings watching YouTube.
With Mike Smith. Is that what you're thinking of? Yeah, you dreamt that. That didn't happen.
All right.
But you could have been watching YouTube by 2007. I think it was the era when, do you remember how there was like a 9-minute or 10-minute cap on how long videos could be?
Yeah.
Because all new video sharing platforms seems to be they start off really short and then they get longer and longer and longer.
Yeah.
And then eventually they're like, yeah, put up a 60-hour video. We don't care. That's the future of TikTok, people. And there was that period, wasn't there, where if people put up a 30-minute TV show onto YouTube, which they did a lot in the early days of YouTube before proper online telly on-demand stuff was a thing, you'd have to watch it in 3 bits.
Yeah.
And then often part 2 would be missing. It'd be really annoying. But it was also an era when people were starting to upload videos of their children doing silly things so that everyone else could go, oh, look at that silly child doing a silly thing.
Charlie bit my finger.
That was becoming a fad because YouTube was here. And so what happened in this case is in 2007, as I say, this Stephanie Lentz, an American woman, put a video of her 13-month-old child. Does that still count as a baby?
Yes.
Not quite a toddler.
Not quite a toddler.
So we are allowed to call it the Dancing Baby.
This baby
case.
Obviously could stand and dance, but not all babies can stand and dance at 13 months.
Oh, so it was a high achiever. Is that what you're saying?
It was a super baby. That's why she was putting it on YouTube. She's going, look at my baby. It's a super baby.
Look at this super baby who is dancing to a Prince track. It was the 1984 Prince hit Let's Go Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That the baby was going crazy too.
Yeah, the super baby, yeah.
The super baby. It was a very short video. Don't be thinking that, I mean, I said at that point there was probably a 10-minute cap.
There was not a 10-minute dancing video.
There were not 10 minutes of this baby dancing. It was a very short video.
29 seconds, I believe.
Of this baby dancing to the Prince track. At that time, Universal Music Publishing was the publisher of the Prince catalogue in charge of his song rights. And what they did was they basically got this video blocked. So they went to YouTube. This was the early days of YouTube. So this wasn't super intelligent AI-driven content ID like we have now. They went to YouTube and they said, OK, under American copyright law, you are obliged to remove content that includes our music without permission. We're saying that this video of this dancing baby, it has music that we control. Prince song, actually, they control, not the recording. It's our song that we represent, and we are saying it's not there of our permission. So you, YouTube, under American copyright law, are obliged to remove it. And that is what YouTube did.
Yes, they did. Although Lentz then came back and argued that the way the track appeared in her video was fair use under US copyright law and demanded that YouTube reinstate the clip, which it did.
Yes, so Lentz uploaded the video, Universal had it taken down, Lentz complained, YouTube put the video back, and that could have been the end of it.
It could.
Which would have made this a very short podcast.
Yes. I mean, we probably, to be honest, wouldn't have done a podcast episode on
it. Yeah, someone said it would have been unnecessary to tell that story 13 years after the fact. Well, 12 years after the fact. 13 years. Whatever.
A number of years.
Quite some time after the fact. However, even though YouTuber put the video back, Lentz then, supported by this campaigning organisation in the US that goes by the name the Electronic Frontier Foundation, decided to sue Universal on the basis that they had no right to request, nay, demand, that the dancing baby video be removed under the part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US that provides the famous takedown system. And so, basically, what Lentz and the EFF were raising was an interesting question about the takedown system under American copyright law and whether or not this thing called fair use must be considered by a copyright owner before they demand a website like YouTube remove content on copyright grounds.
Yes, because crucially, if it does count as fair use, you would not require a license to use it.
No, maybe we should talk a little bit about this thing called fair use.
How about we do that?
Let's talk about copyright exceptions. Are you ready for a little bit of copyright law?
Well, I mean, I very rarely have any choice in the matter.
I think anybody who clicked on a podcast titled as this one is should be expecting at least a few minutes of Chris's copyright law tutorial as part of this podcast.
I don't know, they might have been expecting something to do with Ally McBeal. That had a dancing baby in it, didn't
it? Oh, did it?
I think so. I can't remember, it was the 90s.
I do remember there being some sort of dancing baby thing, which is possibly why this ended up being called the dancing baby case. Was it alluding to that?
Yeah, why didn't they just call it the super baby?
Which could be called the super baby case.
It should be the super baby case.
Anyway, let's
Prince
talk...
Prince versus the super baby is still a good name.
Let's talk about fair use. That's what we're really here to do today, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to talk...
It's not even that. I mean, it's not... I would say it was about on track for development of an infant. Anyway, it's not really a super baby. I just wanted to clarify that in case anyone's wondering about my knowledge of child development.
Slightly beyond average?
No, I'd say about in line with average.
I am going to argue that it's more likely people tuned in expecting Chris's copyright tutorial than it is Andy's debate of standard progression of child skills.
Look, all children are different. If your child is not standing and dancing in YouTube videos at the age of 13 months, don't worry, they'll get there.
Yeah, and you'll think of all the money you'll save on legal bills. So well done for having a non-dancing baby. Anyway, fair use.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Can I talk about that? So, copyright gives copyright owners, artists and songwriters, record labels and music publishers, etc., control over their work. That's what copyright is all about. It's all about control. So what copyright law does is it says, okay, if you own the copyright in a song or a recording, even if it's a Prince track, then you can control what happens to that recording. And you can control things like the copying of that recording, or the communication of that recording, or the public performance of that recording. These are all the controls that come with the copyright. And if anyone else wants to do anything with your music, like, for example, film their baby dancing to it, and then post that on a video site like YouTube, if people want to do any of those things, because you control your music, they have to come to you for permission. That's what copyright is all about. You sell them your permission, and that's how copyright makes money. So that's nice and straightforward, isn't it?
It is.
You followed all of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it would only be confusing if there were exceptions to that.
Yeah, it would only be confusing if there were exceptions to that. Because what copyright law does is it gives you a few pages of saying, okay, copyright's all about control. If you're a copyright owner, these are all the ways in which you control your work. Anyone else wants to do any of these things, have to come for your permission, sell the permission, then you can make some money. That's all great. Draws a line and then says in very big 67-point bold text...
It doesn't. That would be really hard to read.
But it should. Except, and then copyright law provides some exceptions. So these are basically scenarios in which a third party can make use of a piece of copyright material so they can copy it or communicate it or perform it in public or whatever without getting the copyright owner's permission. Now, how these exceptions work varies greatly from country to country. In most copyright systems, particularly European copyright systems, usually there's a specific list of exceptions. So it will say, these are the precise scenarios where there is an exception to copyright law. So it will include things like critical analysis will be in there. Parody is quite often in there. Private copying is in there. Not the UK, as it happens, but most copyright
systems. There was that
week. There was about a week when we had the private copy exception.
We've only recently got the parody exception.
Exactly, around about the same time, in fact. So most copyright systems are providing specific lists of exceptions. And so if you want to make use of copyright work without the copyright owner's permission, you have to go down that list and try and find one that applies to you. So you could say that in some ways those are quite narrow exceptions. The crucial thing is that American copyright law, rather than having this specific list, has this thing called fair use.
Yeah.
Where it just says you can make use of copyright material without the copyright owner's permission if that use is fair use, which is, well, a little bit ambiguous. So what the hell does that mean? Actually, in UK copyright law, we have something similar but much narrower called fair dealing. But the American concept of fair use is a very wide concept. And you might think, well, why is it that American copyright law is providing a much wider, more ambiguous exception to the specific list of much better defined exceptions that you'll get elsewhere, and particularly in the European copyright systems? And ultimately, it's because sometimes copyright and free speech collide. And of course, in America, under the First Amendment of the American Constitution, they have a very strong free speech right. So we like to say in this country, this United Kingdom, oh, it's a free country, I can say what I like. But actually, free speech rights in the UK, well, for starters, they come from the European Convention of Human Rights. Yeah. So we have free speech rights in this country because of the European Convention of Human Rights, as does the rest of Europe. But the crucial point is that generally, free speech rights in America are much stronger than they are in Europe. And so therefore, American copyright law is much more sensitive to this clash between free speech and copyright. Hence, this very wide, ambiguous exception to copyright called fair use. And I mean, so much time has been dedicated to trying to ascertain what the hell constitutes fair use. And you'll find in most copyright cases in America, so if somebody makes use of your track or your song or whatever without permission, and you sue them for copyright infringement, which is what the law says you should do, if somebody uses your music without permission, you sue them, that person, if it's an American case, will immediately say, ah, it's fair use. I was allowed to use your music because it's fair use. And then you have to go to court and everyone has to debate what the hell fair use means and whether or not it applies in this case. So basically, what Stephanie Lenz was saying, backed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, was having her baby dancing to a Prince track, and the Prince track was just in the background. It wasn't even like cleverly synchronized into the video.
And this is 2007. The quality is bad.
This is early days YouTube. This wasn't a clever YouTuber doing something really neat. It was literally it playing in the back room in the kitchen, I think, and the baby dancing along. That constitutes fair use. And I have to say, on that point, I think she's damn right.
Okay.
I think sometimes fair use is abused because it's unnecessarily ambiguous, etc., etc. But I would say, yeah, that is definitely fair use. So she was right about that point. But that wasn't really what this case was about. This case was about what do we do with the concept of fair use when applying another bit of copyright law, which I've already alluded to, which is what the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in America says about takedown systems.
Yes, so that's the other bit of copyright law involved in this case, which is the safe harbours oft discussed on the podcast known as Setlist. So this copyright safe harbour applies in lots of countries around the world, but in the US it comes from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, as you already said, which is a bit of legislation from the 90s, which was aiming to bring copyright law up to date for the internet age.
Although arguably too soon.
Yeah.
Because obviously the World Wide Web was only invented in the early 90s. So it was admirable for the American.
It was very forward thinking.
To try and fix all of the issues of copyright law as mainstream internet usage was beginning. But it all happened too soon. So actually, in many ways, the DMCA hasn't been that helpful. But it did introduce this thing called Safe Harbor.
Yes, which basically was designed to protect internet companies from being held liable for the unlicensed hosting or distribution of content across their networks by their customers.
Yeah, so what those internet companies were saying, and this was happening in Europe at the same time as the US, They were basically saying to lawmakers, as internet usage goes mainstream, and so up until this point, I mean, the internet wasn't new, but previously, generally, the internet was used by big business and academia and government and then really, really geeky people on the old message boards. And what they were basically saying was, as internet usage goes mainstream, as everybody gets internet access, because we are assuming correctly that as soon as people have internet access, they're going to start infringing copyright left, right and centre. They're going to start sharing copyright protected material over these networks. If we, the companies providing the networks, the servers, the websites, the tools that people use to infringe copyright, can be held liable for that infringement, because usually under copyright law, not only the person directly involved in the infringement can be held liable, people who facilitate the infringement can sometimes also be held liable for said infringement. And so the internet companies were basically saying, if we can be held liable for our users' infringement, this isn't going to work, because so many people are going to infringe so much copyright, the liabilities that we would face would be billions and billions of dollars. We can't take on that liability. So we need you, Congress in America and the EU in Europe, we need you to put these safe harbours into copyright law that basically say that if our users use our networks, our servers, our websites, our tools to infringe copyright, that we can't be held liable for that infringement. So that's kind of what the copyright safe harbour says, although the safe harbour does put one requirement on these internet companies in order to get that protection.
That being that they have to have a takedown system whereby copyright owners can alert the company to the fact that copyright is being infringed. And then once that's done, the internet company has to take down the infringing content in order to avoid becoming liable.
Yeah, so the takedown system is the very important quid pro quo of this safe harbour protection. In order for you not to be liable for your user's infringement, you need to have a system in place whereby a copyright owner can say, hang on a second, that video, that file, that web page is infringing our copyright, you need to remove it. And if you don't, you will lose safe harbour protection, and then we can sue you for copyright infringement for facilitating the infringement. So that's what the safe harbour says. Obviously, the reason we've been talking about it endlessly on Setlist is because the music industry has been campaigning for safe harbour reform, particularly in Europe over the last X years, arguing that websites like YouTube shouldn't even have safe harbour protection, that safe harbour protection was intended for ISPs and for server hosting companies, not for video sharing websites like YouTube.
Because in the 90s, video sharing websites like YouTube had not been conceived of yet.
Yeah, so it can't possibly be that Congress and the EU were anticipating websites like YouTube having this safe harbour protection because they couldn't even conceive YouTube. That's been the safe harbour story in recent years, although not relevant to this case. So in this case, what we're saying is, okay, so YouTube is claiming safe harbour protection, therefore it needs to have a takedown system to get that protection. It's an American company, so it tends to take its obligations from American copyright law, even when it's operating outside of the US, which, you know, shouldn't really, but that's kind of what it does. But this was an American case, American video, American musician, American music rights owner. So it is all about US law.
American baby.
American baby. So everything in this story is American. So it's fine to look to DMCA and say, okay, under DMCA, YouTube is obliged to remove copyright infringing content when made aware of it in order to have safe harbour protection. So that's what was happening here. Universal was saying, this video infringes our copyright, so you have to remove it through your takedown system. Otherwise, you might be liable for that copyright infringement. That is what is happening. However, of course, once Stephanie Lenz and the EFF had said, well, hang on a second, the use of the Prince track in this video was fair use, so therefore, there wasn't any copyright infringement. Because it can't be copyright infringement if it's fair use. Which obviously is why YouTube put it back up.
Yeah.
But what the Electronic Frontier Foundation was saying is because there wasn't any infringement in this case, Universal should never have issued a takedown request in the first place. And actually, the DMCA does anticipate abuse of takedown.
Mm.
So the music industry would argue that one of the problems with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is it provides a safe harbour. It says that in order to have safe harbour protection, you've got to have a takedown system. And it doesn't really define in any great detail what that takedown system should look like. And so we've had lots of cases over the last 20 years of copyright owners saying, this website's claiming safe harbour protection, but has a pretty shoddy takedown system. We don't believe they should have safe harbour protection. And originally, those cases tended to go against the copyright owners. And then more recently, with like the Cox case and the Grande case, they're going more in the favour of the copyright owners. But while DMCA doesn't really say a great deal about what a takedown system should look like, it does anticipate people using takedown systems to take down content when there isn't actually a copyright infringement to answer. I think to overcome fears that people might abuse this system just to get content they don't like taken down.
Yeah.
So another free speech thing, I guess. Mm. What's to stop people coming along to YouTube and saying, that video where you say something nasty about me or about somebody I like or whatever, I don't want that to be on the internet. So I'm going to issue a takedown and get it removed and hope nobody notices. So the law does anticipate abuse of takedown. And so basically what was going on in this case was the EFF were saying that Universal had abused the takedown system to remove a video which had no infringing material in it because the use of the Prince track was fair use. That was abuse of takedown, and that was the grounds of the lawsuit. They were basically, on Stephanie Lenz's behalf, suing Universal for abuse of takedown.
At each turn of the case, Universal argued that forcing copyright owners to consider the pretty ambiguous concept of fair use on every single piece of content uploaded to the internet that contains one of its works without permission would put an unrealistic burden on rights holders, which I guess is a fair argument. So while an uploader might subsequently successfully counter a takedown request by pleading fair use, as in this case, there shouldn't be an obligation on rights holders to consider that fair use initially before they send that takedown notice.
Yeah, because I suppose even in the late 2000s, already, the amount of videos going up on YouTube every day containing copyright material was phenomenal. And of course, I mean, since this case was filed and it has continued to rumble through the courts, that has only become more true, that more and more videos are being loaded all the time, more copyright infringed material is going up. Of course, over that time, YouTube has made its takedown system ever more sophisticated.
Yes.
To help copyright owners deal with the fact that this huge quantity of content is going live every day. Who's monitoring it? How are you monitoring it? Yeah, and so basically what Universal were saying is it's already a freaking nightmare monitoring all of this content for infringing material. If, when we spot some infringing material, we then have to call a committee meeting and say, do you think this is fair use? Maybe this isn't fair use. It was all saying, that's just unrealistic. And I guess what they were saying is, surely, although in theory there are rules against abuse of takedown, surely a more practical, sensible solution is if we spot content that's in there without permission, we have it removed. If the person who created that video then thinks, well, hang on a second, that's fair use, there shouldn't have been a takedown, at that point, the user can go to YouTube, dispute the takedown, as happened in this case. YouTube can then look at the video, and if they think, yeah, they're right, reinstate it, as happened in this case. And surely that would be a much more sensible way for everyone to get on with their lives, was basically what Universal was saying.
So this litigation spent years going through the motions, as we've already alluded to. It was a long-running case. The key ruling, though, is from 2015, when it reached the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court, which did not agree with Universal. It argued that rights holders did need to consider fair use when issuing takedown notices.
And before they issued the takedown, not after.
So that seems like a win for Lenz and the EFF. All good, except the appeal judges then said that the consideration didn't actually need to be particularly rigorous. And as long as the issuer of the takedown notice genuinely believed that there was no fair use concern, then, hey, fine, no need to worry about it. Carry on as you were.
I suppose that second part of the ruling was in response to Universal saying, well, hang on a second, if we have to look at every video and consider whether or not it's fair use, and that's quite an ambiguous concept, so how much work is that going to involve? Do we need to have legal experts in the room to do this? That's not going to be practical. So in essence, what the court was saying, in order to find some sort of fudge in the middle, was, no, you do definitely need to consider whether or not it is fair use. So we are putting that obligation on you as someone issuing a takedown statement. But we're saying it's not that big an obligation, because providing whoever is looking at the video on your behalf considers it, they don't need to go and consult a lawyer. They don't need to have a big academic debate on it. Providing they look at it and they think, is it fair use? Is it not fair use? Nah, it's not fair use. And then issue a takedown. That is enough consideration.
Of course, because this case took so long to get to that point, the world had moved on. The internet moves very quickly, doesn't it? And this has taken a long time in internet terms. And so by the time that ruling was made, actually, takedown systems had generally become automated, certainly for sites like YouTube. And so it wasn't so much the case of a person sending an email saying, I don't like this, please take it off the internet. And the Ninth Circuit did acknowledge that fact, although it did ultimately decide it didn't need to consider whether or not an automated system could consider something as nuanced as the concept of fair use, because that is not what was included in the original case.
Yeah, no automated system was actually involved in the removal of this video back in 2007. It was an interesting point that was raised in 2015, because if we're saying that before issuing a takedown notice, the copyright owner needs to consider fair use, but they don't have to give it a huge amount of consideration, but nevertheless, a human brain is considering it. But now takedowns are generally being issued automatically by machines, which are automatically spotting content as it is uploaded. It's an important question. I understand why they didn't want to answer it. Well, first of all,
difficult.
Yeah, exactly. First of all, yes, it wasn't relevant to this case. But also, yeah, that's a very difficult question, because can a machine consider fair use? I mean, even if we had very specific exceptions like in Europe, and if it was critical analysis or parody, it would have to be a very powerful AI to be able to work out that that video is using that content in order to critique it, or particularly in order to mock it, to make fun of it. But, you know, a wide concept like fair use, I mean, it's tricky for people. I mean, the idea that relatively junior members of staff at record companies or music publishers can make that call is quite ambitious. But I think that's why they were saying it doesn't have to be particularly rigorous consideration. So they're kind of saying, yeah, a junior member of staff probably can do this and that's fine. But the idea a machine can do it, well, I don't see a machine can do it unless there's an incredibly clever technology I don't yet know of. And so actually, that is a really important question. You're saying that there needs to be consideration of fair use before takedown is issued, although not rigorous assessment. But what about when a machine is issuing the takedown? But as we say, the judges chose not to mull on that, with the convenient get out that this case, even though the world has moved on a lot in the last 8 years, relates to something that happened in 2007. So the automated bit wasn't relevant there. So we don't have to worry about this. Let some other judges have to consider that sometime in the future.
Yeah, so that was the 2015 ruling, which was, it was a bit of a fudge to balance things out on both sides, which, I mean, obviously that ended up with no one being happy. So they both appealed, both sides, referring it up to the Supreme Court. Universal mainly appealed on the judgment that if Lentz pushed for damages, she didn't have to first prove actual monetary loss, something the music publisher wanted judges to insist on in order to reduce the chances of it ever actually having to pay out any money to her.
Yes, a damages technicality, and obviously the reason why Universal wanted that is because it would be really hard for Stephanie Lentz to prove any monetary loss. So the outcome of the entire case, even if in essence the ruling went to Universal, might be the damages check was for $10, and so a big win for Universal. So yeah, there was a damages technicality that Universal definitely wanted a higher court to intervene on.
Lentz, meanwhile, focused on the ambiguities as to just how much consideration a rights holder had to give to fair use before issuing a takedown notice. I mean, the words the judges used in the Ninth Circuit appeal ruling was it had to be in good faith.
Yes.
Which is quite vague.
Yeah, so we've got the ambiguous concept of fair use, and then the ambiguous concept of how you employ that ambiguous concept before issuing your takedown statement. So yeah, it's true, the Ninth Circuit have made a vague element of copyright law even vaguer. Hence why the EFF felt that there needed to be more clarity on that. I guess to stop, I mean, as we've already acknowledged, in some ways all of this is irrelevant now because a machine is doing it anyway, but to stop somebody at a record company or a publisher just going, oh, I've got to think about fair use. Ah, oh, it's clearly not fair use. Right, I'm going to issue my takedown.
And if it ever came up in court, just being it being perfectly fine to just say, oh, yeah, I did definitely consider it.
I definitely considered it. That's good faith. So, yeah, that was what the other side wanted. So neither side was happy with 2015 ruling. Universal wanted a higher court to change the rules on potential damages from this case, while the EFF side were saying, I mean, obviously, in some ways, they got what they wanted, but they hadn't got enough of what they wanted. And so they wanted some clarity on the consideration process from a higher court. Supreme Court, no less.
Yes, and the Supreme Court judges quickly knocked back Universal's appeal on the damages question. But it did say it was considering a review of the judgment regarding the impact of fair use on the takedown procedure, which might have given us an answer on the whole automated systems question. And it did go to the US Department of Justice and ask for its opinion on fair use and takedowns. But then, June 2017, they thought, don't want to. They said, no, 2015 ruling stands. That's the final ruling. All done. I mean, possibly they looked into the complex question of whether automated systems could consider fair use and went, well, this is really hard. Let's not bother.
Let's not bother with that. You're right. For about a year, we were expecting more consideration, not on the damages bit, as you say, but on the consideration bit. And I mean, even just some more clarity on the human consideration process. Maybe a little checklist would have been good. And yeah, had they even gone into the automated side, it would have been even more interesting to hear what they discussed. But we didn't get that because they ultimately declined to hear the case at all.
Yes, and it was a year after that, in June 2018, that essentially it all came to a disappointing close when we learned that a settlement between the two sides had been agreed, basically all fizzled out. There was no big dramatic finish. It fizzled out quietly over a number of years until they had a settlement with undisclosed terms.
So we do not know what that settlement consisted of.
We did get statements, though, kind of begrudgingly saying things were a little bit better now because of the other side. Certainly not bigging them up at any stretch, but that was probably one of the terms, is that they would both issue statements that didn't say, look at these assholes. So David Kakakis, Universal Music Publishing Group's chief counsel, said, UMPG takes great pride in protecting the rights of our songwriters. Great pride. Note. Inherent in that objective is our desire to take a thoughtful approach to enforcement matters. Thoughtful. See, they think about it. The Lentz case helped us develop a fair and tempered process for evaluation of potential takedowns. So it was good. It was like, you know, it was kind of helpful in the end.
It was a learning
despite
experience.
Despite being long and tedious. Lentz then issued her own statement alongside that saying, from what I have seen, UMPG's current takedown reviews process is much better. If UMPG's current process had been in place 11 years ago, when I posted my video of my young son dancing, I probably wouldn't have had to contact the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
So basically, it had been an 11-year learning process for the music industry on how to issue takedowns, even though almost certainly the whole thing's now automated, I'm sure. I mean, I'm not accusing any one rights owner of this, just make that clear. Otherwise, the third of these setlist specials might be the Universal versus CMU libel action. But I'm sure rights owners, through the automated system, are issuing takedowns against videos, which are arguably, and in some cases, definitely fair use every day of the week. It's an automated process, and the machine isn't thinking about fair use or even capable of thinking about.
The machine doesn't care.
Fair use. Yeah, what's fair? That's the eternal question, isn't it? So, yeah, as you say, the case kind of fizzled out, although both sides insisting that some learning had occurred over the decade that it was rumbling through the
system.
And that's
nice.
That is nice.
If there's one thing you can say about this. I'm not sure you can say it was nice. It happened.
We got some clarity.
We did get some clarity.
We did get some clarity, which was, despite all of the issues that Universal kind of rightly raised with the concept that someone issuing a takedown against a website or an internet company claiming safe harbor protection must consider fair use before issuing the takedown, not just subsequently relent once the accused infringer complains and saying, yeah, probably you're right, it's fair use, before you issue the takedown. That is definite. We've got that as a precedent set in this case, even if the judges who set that precedent acknowledged that it doesn't really work in an automated age. And neither they nor the Supreme Court were willing to give the whole Content ID question any consideration whatsoever.
Yeah, so that's another classic lawsuit, all wrapped up in a neat little bow for you, the listener. That's very nice for you. For more special editions of Setlist like this one, head to your favourite podcast provider and hit subscribe on Setlist, not just randomly.
Yeah, don't subscribe to every single podcast in the world. That'd be a disaster.
It would make life very difficult for you. So I would suggest just hit subscribe on Setlist. Unsubscribe to all other podcasts. You don't need them. You just need this one.
They're probably full of copyright infringing material that's definitely not fair use.
As a little bonus, if you do hit that subscribe, wanting other special editions of Setlist, you will also, at no extra charge, get our weekly normal episodes in which we round up a week's worth of key music business developments.
Almost weekly.
Almost week. You, well,
the existence of the special editions.
Yeah, all right.
It's because we're not always weekly.
Most weeks. But for more details on all that, go to setlistpodcast.com. You'll find links to a lot of places where you can subscribe. If you haven't yet chosen your favourite podcast provider, I mean, maybe this is the first podcast you've ever listened to. Maybe you just have been waiting for the day you could listen to a show that involved dancing babies. And this is probably the first one, I would imagine. But yeah, if you need links, we got them. If you want to go back and look through old episodes, we got them.
Including the first of our top 10 lawsuits, which was the Blurred Lines Songfest case.
And all of our 20th anniversary special editions, which you might not have listened to yet, which they're all brilliant.
They're all in there.
Yeah.
More Safe Harbour.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of that. If you want more Safe Harbour, that's the place to go. But yeah, that is all we've got time for on this episode, except for me to just do the credits like I always do. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. Produced by Matt Peaty. Edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.